set up to be on this picture at the end. Thank you all for coming. My name is Linda Powell Jensen. The program I'm going to present this evening is called The Mine Hike, and this program was developed by Rudy Edmonds. Many of you heard of his name. He was a geologist who served the community for many years, and he's the man that was instrumental in getting the Portal Museum built, which has met its demise temporarily. But anyway, Rudy put together this program, and what you're getting tonight is kind of a, as is the case during reconstruction time, a modified version. Normally we would be walking up the road and looking at the mountainside and talking about where the ore body was found, and then going up to the edge of Miners Village and chatting a little more. But we'll do it all from here. So I'll put the, and then followed by a slideshow, which does include pictures of some of the operation underground. And Abby had let some of the workers know that, you know, if they wanted to come in late and see some of the pictures, hopefully they'd be able to. So anyway, this is J. H. Holden. The initial information about ore bodies in Railroad Creek Valley was noted by Great Northern Railroad people who went through here in 1887 looking for a route through the mountains for the railroad. J. H. Holden was actually born in Massachusetts in 1855. He came west at the age of 19, first to Virginia City, then to Denver, and ultimately to Seattle, where he met Victor Denny. Those of you who are familiar with the Seattle area know the Denny name very well. They were a founding family in Seattle. There's numerous places named after them, streets, triangles, etc. He works for the family on and off. In 1893 and 94, he came with them to Lake Chelan to set up their camps for prospecting vacations. And in 1896, he and Victor came over and were actually prospecting along the lake near Lucerne. And Victor got called home. So Holden came up into the Railroad Creek Valley by himself. And he was exploring both sides of the valley. And in August, he was hunting up on Copper Mountain. And he followed a deer into a ravine, and he got his deer for his food, and he spotted an ore body. He took some samples, he went out and filed a claim, and he filed the claim in his name only, even though he'd been grubstaked by the Denny family. The Denny family sued him. The case went all the way to the Washington State Supreme Court, and Holden prevailed, and he became the sole owner of the claims. He was not interested in developing the mine himself. His interests were in selling the mining claims, but he did have to come in. He built a cabin and started digging some tunnels and developing some promotional materials. He leased the properties initially. The first company that took a lease was called Drummers, and they built more tunnels, built a camp, and started a railroad bed. Then he leased it to a company called Granby, and Granby extended their leases several times, but they ultimately decided not to buy. At the time he started his promotional activities, Holden also established a company called the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company, and he sold stock and set himself up as president. As the years progressed, he and the leases were not getting turning into purchases. He was running low on funds, so he borrowed $7,500 from a banker named Crooker Perry. Good name for a banker. In 1918, Holden died of cancer. Now, prior to his death, he had been a very prominent person in the Chelan community. He had married Alma Lord, who was a Chelan rancher's daughter. She was 20 years younger than he was. They had four children. He was an industrialist. He was a philanthropist. He was very involved in his church, and the family was very involved in music. When Holden died, Crooker Perry sued Alma for the amount owing on the debt, forcing her to sell it at auction. And Perry showed up and he purchased the properties. And like Holden, he also was more interested in selling, so again he leased it. Granted, he took some additional leases. And again, and then they again decided not to pursue it. In the meantime, one of Granby's employees named Brennan had gone to work for Britannia Mines in British Columbia, and he convinced them to look into the Holden properties. So Britannia took a lease in 1928, and they purchased the property in 1930 and set up the Howe Sound Company, Chelan Division. Howe Sound was one of their subsidiary companies named after the sound in Canada where Britannia is located. They started construction in earnest in 1931, and it was abruptly halted because of the Depression. In 1936, they came back in and started in earnest, building all the buildings in the mine and mill area, and building all of the buildings in the town site area, including the chalets. Now, in the early efforts to get the ore out of here, all efforts had been directed to building a railroad from the mine to the lake to haul the rock down lake. But as the trucking industry produced or progressed and trucking became much more viable, the idea of a railroad was dropped and they turned to road building. So the switchbacks and the road were also built to come into the mine area. The ore body itself, if we were walking up the road, we would stop near the footbridge and look to Copper Mountain. And many of you are familiar with the great big red tailings pile over up above the Honeyman Heights area, or near the Honeyman Heights area. There's another pile to the left of it, and up higher that used to be visible but no longer is through the trees, although I did notice you could spot it from up in the miners' village, is a third small tailings pile, and it's at the base of a rock outcropping. So if you're facing the mountain and see those three piles and go to see that big rock cropping, the ravine where he found the ore body is right below that. The ore body is a half mile wide and 80 feet thick, and it goes at an angle down into the mountain. As they developed it, there is 58 miles of tunnels inside that mountain. And the main haulage level, which we all know as the third level where the main porthole was called the 1500 foot level. They mined the three levels above there prior to 1945, and following 1945, they mined below the 1500 foot level. And again, the building of the mill and producing the rock down into the powdered ore that was hauled out of here is what finally made it economical enough to put the mine into production. Production started in 1937, and the first barge of ore went to Chelan in the spring of 1948. It was a big fanfare when it left the dock down here, and it was a huge celebration when the first load arrived in Chelan. It was an economic boon for Chelan County, as you can imagine, and all of central Washington. And they had dignitaries at the Chelan dock, and had a parade following the trucks hauling the ore down to the railroad station at Beebe. And that is basically the way the process worked, was to take it out of here by barge and get it down to Beebe. In the early 50s, at our dinner table, there was already discussion, even before we left, about concern about the mine running out. And they were digging what they called an east drift, looking for a new vein of ore, but it never came through. There were three factors that contributed to the mine closing. One was the ore body was running out. The grade of ore was getting even significantly less. It was only 2% ore in the first place, though. 40 pounds of a ton of ore. Not a lot. Why they had to process it to get it out of here. The second factor was the mill itself was 20 years old. It was wearing out. In fact, at one of our miners' reunions, the mine superintendent said that the fellow who was the mill superintendent and some of the workers in the mill worked together to make some changes in the mill processing that actually enabled it to run that mill 2 years longer than it would have. So that's one tidbit that many people are not aware of, but that mine and the workers and management have a very good relationship with this mine and work together on things. As far as the output, the third factor that contributed, and that was probably the biggest one, is copper mines were opening up in South America and the price of ore dropped significantly. So it was just no longer profitable to operate here. In April of 1957, the workers were notified that the final day of operation would be July 1 of 1957. So it ran about 20 years. The community at the peak, the population here was over 600, slightly 600. I'll have some pictures later showing the town site. Some of you that were with me yesterday, you'll see pictures of some of the places we walked yesterday, including some of the houses we talked about. But it was a very profitable operation, and I'm going to give you statistical data, which is in those years' values, not current year values. A few summers ago when I was doing this program, some guy that was a mathematician came and he was quoting us the current values of it at that time. Quite a bit different than now, but in terms of quantity, there were 212 million pounds of copper taken out of this mountain. 0.6 million ounces of gold. 40 million pounds of zinc. That was the second in volume. And 2 million ounces of silver. Now the dollar value shifts greatly. The copper was worth 70.5 million. The gold was worth 21.5 million. The zinc worth 5.5 million. And the silver about 2.5 million. And as I mentioned, it was a very low grade copper. We're going to see some stopes inside the mine. Some of those stopes are 900 feet high and 80 feet wide. There's some pretty big holes in there. As far as the labor, the wages, these are different. I had some labor wages yesterday. 1941 were $5 to $6 a day, and 1948 were $10 to $12 a day. And the mine was very crucial to World War II. Men who worked in the mine were exempt from draft, and they had soldiers working here for a time during the war. So it was a very important mine in the United States. At the peak of production, they ran three shifts. Underground, there would be 100 to 200 men on a shift. In the mill, about 40. And then mechanics on the surface, 8 to 10. And that doesn't include the count of the few people, the transportation and some of the other surface crews. But that's just the regular people on three shifts. The other surface crews and transportation were only a day shift type organization. So at this point, we're going to take some pictures, and I've got to shift here to a different program. I'll show you some pictures of what the operation looked like.
Linda, did you say that the first ore went down to Chelan in 1948?
38. 38. Okay. Did I say 48? I meant 38.
No, I might have heard you wrong.
April, I believe, was the month that they went out.
Do they have a picture of that truck going out or that shipment going out anywhere?
Not in this program. Whoops, I got on the wrong one. How did that happen? Oh, shoot. Sorry about that. Yes. Not in this program. It's in, I think it's in the one I'm doing Friday night. Okay, the start of the program is Lake Chelan because that was the critical factor in getting the ore out of here. They always knew they'd have to ship it down the lake, but as I said in earlier years, they thought that was going to be done via railroad. In fact, there was even, I think, at some point, a discussion of a railroad running all the way down the lake, but that, if you travel up and down the lake, you can figure out that was going to be pretty much, I don't know, not going to happen, which is also why I'm sure Great Northern dropped the area in a hurry. This is a picture of the third level where the portal was. The building on the right was the machine shop where the mechanics worked to keep the equipment done, ready to go, the drill bit sharpened. And the second story on this building, which isn't visible in the picture, is where the offices were. The building in the center in the back, we call the dry, Rudy refers to it as the change house. When the guys were going to work, they would go in there and change into their diggers, as they called them, their underground clothes, and hard hats, and leave their street clothes there. When they came off ship, they showered there and changed into their street clothes. Their diggers, they had these flat rectangular baskets that in for many years were flower baskets in the building. They've kind of gone to more efficient flower baskets, but they put their hats and their small pieces of clothing, and then they'd hang their mining outer clothing, their shirts and overalls and stuff on the outside of the baskets, and they were attached to a pulley, and they'd pull them up in the ceiling, and they'd dry and would be dry by the time the next shift started. The building on the right is some sort of utility shed that was at the third level.
Do you know what year these pictures were taken?
When?
Yeah, well, like, was there a date?
Some of them are. There's a date. It'll show that some of these were taken after the announcement of the closure, some additional documentation. But there are also some that are from the earlier years, which you can kind of tell. There's another picture of the portal. And this slideshow does not have some of the pictures of the inside of the mill process. But if you do go up in the museum, there was a fellow here that he actually hiked in from the other side to get a job, not knowing the Harden Chalan. He was a mountaineer. And he was also a photographer by hobby. They did give him a job. He's a chemist. Some of you may have heard his name. It was Larry Penberthy. He was one of the original founders of the predecessor company to REI, and some of the mountaineering equipment designs that he developed are still in use. But anyway, photography was his hobby. He has the museum, the little one in the village center around the top. They have pictures that he has taken both underground of the mill process. So those were taken, I think, in 38 early on, because he was only here a couple of years. This is a picture of the porthole. The sign is important. Safety first. This company had an excellent safety calls record. They emphasize safety. I tried to research information on fatalities. We only have about 17 names, and I don't have full detail on the accidents of what caused those. But if you think about operating 20 years of less than a death a year in an industry as dangerous as mining, they really did have a good record. This is a picture of the footbridge that they had that was built. I believe this is the last one that was here. They did have one of their footbridges, but it was similar style that got taken partially out by an avalanche. This is a picture of the what they call the man train, the little wooden boxes. The guys crawled inside those cars to go back into the mine. You can see the electric overhead trolley lines and the trolley now. The engineer has his hat off because he's having his picture taken. I can assure you he would not be going into the mine without his hard hat on. And this is another safety lesson. The fellow's holding his headlight in his hand that he's going to attach to his hat. In order to get that headlight, he had to turn in his brass. Every employee had a circular brass token with a hole in it with their employee number on it. And that was every employee, including the women that worked in the mess hall and the fountain lunch, the ones that worked on surface. But it was most crucial for the guys that worked into the mine. In order to get their headlamp, they had to turn in their brass, which was hung on a board. and that signified that they were underground. And when shift was over, if there was not, if the void was not empty, then they would start looking for the person who didn't come out. So that was one of their big safety. Simple but workable. This is a picture of the early part of the portal. You'll see a little bit of wood timbering there. This was a hard rock mine. The wood timbering only went back 100 feet. Overhead lines and the pipes ran all the way back. The engine to the train is sitting there. That's part of the pictures, but this is a mass kind of, the idea is to show that there was some timbering, but very little. There's a picture of the electric train. My dad, actually, that was his job at the last before he passed away when we lived here. And the fellow driving that train was named Denny Spurgeon, but nobody knew his name was Denny. He went by Casey. And again, this is showing it back further in the mine. And at this point, there's no timbering at all, just the water pipes. That one kind of skipped too fast. I think that's just another shot. Yeah, a little bit further back, pushing back. And again, you can see the electric trolley lines running over and that little teeny engine with that headlight on it. This is a picture of the skip. And the skip was the equipment that raised both men and the ore from level to level. It had different type of pieces put on the platform depending on whether ore was on it or whether a person was going to be on it. This is the hoist room, and this is the equipment that ran that skip. And they had, you've probably seen in the downstairs hotel, there, I believe is where the bell signal sign is. Maybe it's in the museum. There's a couple of them around. They had a bell signals, and the bell signals told the operator which level you were on and whether you needed to go up or down. Again, hard hats only off because he was having a picture taken. That's a close-up of the guy. You can see the great big levers and such. That was one of the skilled jobs. This is a very crude cutout of the levels of the mine, and it shows the main haulage tunnel. And up in here, this is the hoist room up here. This is the shaft going all the way down, 1500 level. And here, we'll talk about later, you'll see some individual chutes that were used to actually dump ore down further in the mine to break it up more before they loaded it into cars. I think the library has a copy of this book, or this, it's a little pamphlet that was put together by an engineer that worked up here that has information and statistical data on the mine, but he did the crude drawing. This is the picture looking back into where the tracks divide, and there was an east and a west drift, and they work both directions. The east drift is the one that they were trying to extend under Buckskin, hoping to find the additional ore body, but unfortunately there was not one there. This is a picture of the diamond drillers. This was one of the highest skilled jobs. And diamond drills were used to dig the holes. And I welcome you afterwards if you want to come up and lift these and get an idea. They have a what they call a star bit in the end in that machine shop that I talked about. A good share of the work done in there was sharpening these bits all the time because they had to be resharpened. And they were the ones digging the holes to set the blast, and like I said, the ones that were the highest skilled and the highest paid.
Do you know what the pay was at that time? Yeah, I mean, the annual salary would have been for somebody like that?
Well, I had the daily rates of 41 was $5 to $6 and $10 to $12 in 1948. I think the 51 rate that I talked about yesterday was like $15 a day or something like that. The pay was very good here. They were union, and it was considered better than some of the other mines. In fact, the strike they had up here was because the union was negotiating with three mines at once, and Howe Sound's offer was better than the other two companies. The other two companies were holding out, and they ended up with a strike, which our workers were not happy about. But this is another look at them drilling the holes. and they drill down and then up, and then setting the charges. Stope mining is basically blasting out the rock and working your way up to make a bigger hole and blasting out more rock. And this is, these are the guys waiting for the blast time to clear before they can go in and start assessing. One of the fatalities that we had were two workers who, for unknown reasons, cut their fuses too short. One was killed and one was severely injured. That was one of the fatalities. Again, that was a more skilled job. This shows the debris in the tunnel ready to be hauled out. In the early years, it was all manual. In the later years, they started getting a little bit more sophisticated equipment. These were referred to as drag buckets, where they could pull some of the debris out of the tunnel ways before they actually loaded it into a car to go on to the a track and then over to the skip. This is showing one of the cars. They had side dump cars, and when I talked about those chutes, they would roll it up to one of those chutes and dump it down further so it would break the rock into smaller pieces. This guy is called a mucker. That was the entry level, the mucker, because in the early years, especially, all of the debris, the ore was loaded by hand into these little cars, rolled out to the skip area or to the chute and knocked down. And mucker, very common phrase. They had a 3 ice cream sundae bigger than a banana split in the fountain lunch called a mucker special. And in the 40s, they had a dance every fall called the mucker's balls. That's what the mucker did. He started out, he was the low-level worker. And from there, they could work their way up to higher positions. Here's another picture of a side dump ore. You can see the ore going out of those cars. That's a picture of the skip with ore loaded on it. It's got the capacity cut off on the label there, but it was 85 cubic foot capacity. And that one and this, again, are some older pictures. This is down at one of the lower levels of the ore coming down in, down one of those chutes into the cars. And this is a stope. And as I said, and to give you, again, perspective of the size, let me point out the little man down here. This is miner.
Oh, God.
So that gives you an idea of the size of the stope. So there's more than one of those in there. So there's some pretty big holes. You can see why there's, even after processing, 3 huge piles of tailings. This is, again, it's kind of hard to see, but you're looking into an area of debris, and the whole thing, I mean, very basic mining, and of course, again, you're talking 30s, 40s, and early 50s, but blast the rock, load it up, and take it out and process it. I wish I had more pictures of the inside of the mill operation, because it also is interesting. This is a picture taken in the lunchroom. These are 3 of the ship bosses. On a personal note, the fellow on the right's name was Ed Brewer. Very close friends of our family. They had no kids, but they were aunt and uncle to us kids. And this picture shows the date on the blackboard. So these are some, was part of some of the pictures that were taken after the announcement of the closure had been made.
Was this in the mine?
Pardon?
Was this in the mine?
Yeah, this is the underground lunchroom where the miners could come to have their lunch, not just the shifters, but the other miners would ride the skip up to the lunchroom to have their lunch. They had an underground. And they also had, I believe the lunchroom was where the underground phone was. This is an air shaft. Now, the ventilation system for the mine was a giant fan, a big round orange thing. I think the surface of it was, as a kid I know it was bigger than I was. It was located down closer to the ballpark in another tunnel. Before all this movement was done, those of you who had been in prior years, when you went up to the third level, just as you turned the last switch back, there was a road that went straight on, headed out toward the ballpark. If you went down there, you'd find a big hole. The cement ports supports that held the fan were still there. And people asked, you know, well, was that noisy? Did you hear it? The hum of the fan, as you're in the community, was about as loud as if you walked across the creek and walked by the hydro building, the hum that you hear at the hydro. But you didn't really hear it, as I tell people, you heard it if it stopped, because you suddenly realized you didn't hear your hum. But that was the way they kept fresh air going in and out of the mine. And this is, again, whoops, that old 2000. This is a fellow, I guess I missed another little small shoot there. And this fellow, what he's doing, he's checking for loose rock before he goes into an area. So they may have done some hauling out of it already, but he's checking to see if there's any more before they go in and start major work. This is one of the older pictures of the portal with an older engine than the more current one we saw in the early part. So as I said, these pictures, Rudy collected them from a variety of places. This is a picture of the mill and the trestle that goes across to the mill. And the process worked kind of from top to bottom, basically, how it started. You saw some of those side dump ore cars. That's what the ore came out of the mine in, those side dump ore cars. And the size of the rocks as they came out of the mine, this is about what it would look like size-wise. You can see one when I'm moving up here. And you're welcome to look at these after. And these would be dumped into a crusher called a jaw crusher. And then when the jaw crusher got through, you were looking at a rocks about this size coming out of the jaw crusher. And then the next series down was called the cone crushers. And they worked kind of like a mortar and pistol type thing, you know, where it went around. And when the rocks came out of there, they were little pebbles about the size of the end of your finger. And from there, they went into these great big huge round drums called the ball mills that were extremely noisy. And I will tell you that kids and families couldn't go across into the industrial area at all unless a parent took you. And our dad did a couple of times take us kids up through the, there were steps all the way up through the mill, because the winter time, the guys could climb all the steps to get up to the top to go to work in the mine across the footbridge and up there instead of that. And the ball mills were these great big round drums. And again, I invite you to come up and handle these afterwards. They have these big steel balls in them. And when you walk by them, it was just like this. Of course, guys didn't have ear protection in those days. And these steel balls pounded those little pebbles into powder. And then the next step was that the powder would go into these flotation tanks, where they added a non-toxic chemical. And that would cause the ore to float to the top, and then the wastewater would be on the bottom. And that's one of the things the kids loved to watch, because they'd have these great big bubbles on top. Bubble machine, they were huge bubbles. And you could tell the difference between the zinc and the copper because of the color of the bubbles on top of the water. And there is a couple of pictures of those up in the museum. It was quite an interesting process. And then from the flotation tanks, they went down into the drying vats. The powder went off into this huge drying vat. And if those of you have been here in prior years and ever were up by the old mill structure, if you went in the museum and looked out the back door, there was that giant round tank thing there. That was what the drying vats looked like. And I believe there were two of those, one for each. And again, there's a picture of that up there. And then from the drying vats, it went down the chute and loaded into an ore bucket.
And was there a railroad track that ran from the outside of the portal to the mill? Or how was the ore actually transported into the mill?
That trestle that I was showing you in that previous picture. You can see it a little bit in this picture too, over to the right, right across the top there. The tracks came from the mine out there. In fact, the tracks went all the way out onto that rock pile up there where your water tank is, because the waste rock was dumped out there. The little train brought waste rock out too and dumped up there, in addition to ore that went in the mill. So that track did at that time run all the way out. This is another picture of the mill during the, taken in the fall as opposed to winter.
Linda, would you mind turning that light? It's shining right. Just, it's kind of, when you turn it there. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, sorry about that.
No,
I bumped it. I had it hanging kind of crazy here. This is a picture of one of the tailings pipes. This is the pipes that took the waste out of the mill and into the tailings pile, and they were wooden with the cable around. I don't know if they still have a piece of that left or not. There was one up by the museum. I think it might be salvaged somewhere. And it was done on a dike system, and that's how they moved the pipes back and forth to even out the piles as they grew in size and up.
This was a liquid sludge that came out?
It was a liquid type sludge when it came out, and then, you know, it dried. In fact, the old miners said that the outside, you know, was harder crust, and the further in you got, the softer it was.
It was described to us by these guys as kind of like a cheesecake.
Like a what?
Cheesecake.
I think I'd want to taste it. But, the fellow on the right and the lady in the middle are the Hoggetts, Earl and Oma. And the kid on the left is Terry. And when I babysat him, he was probably younger than the kid in the middle, who I'm assuming is his son. Earl was an ore truck driver. And that was one of the interesting jobs, as you can imagine, going up and down the roads winter and summer. And this is a picture of the ore trucks, three buckets, 500 ton. So 1,500 tons going down on your truck. And the road was much narrower then. There were no Jersey barriers on the switchbacks. not near as many turnouts. They had no radios. But basically, as I recall, there were pretty much a fleet of two trucks running, and so, you know, they kind of knew time-wise during the winter where they were, and other cars weren't on the road except the bus and that, and they had their schedules coordinated. So during the summertime, when people had their vehicles up there, you watched for the dust, because the road wasn't watered, and that's how you watched for traffic, because if you had your car on the road, you had to get out of the way of the ore truck. And as far as we know, there was only one truck lost. And I suspect they salvaged quite a bit of the ore. It was lost on the brakes went out on the switchback, and even though they had the little run-up things on it, it did wreck. But only one in 20 years, again, is pretty good when you think of the conditions under which they were driving. And of course, keeping the road open year-round was high priority, and so transportation of snow removal equipment, the snow go in the back and the grader in the front, and that was done year round.
Don't we still have that?
You know, I don't think you have the original, but I'm not so sure. I'm not sure if it was still here when the village got it or not. There was one here early on, but I thought that the one that Holden had
was from 63.
Was sold out. That they had sold it and was gone. I'm not sure.
The one we have from 63.
And this is a picture of the dock at Lucerne. It's in the same location as today, but as you can see, it was much longer. And I was quite fascinated last summer while I was waiting to leave. A barge came in, and watching them unload a barge compared to the mining days where each bucket had to be hooked by a crane, or if you had vehicles or other things coming in, they were on pallets sitting on top of the empty ore buckets. And those guys just pull up to that ramp, and the loader drives on and picks everything up and hauls it off. Quite a change. That's the size of the crane. And then this is a picture. Whoops, that went too fast on me again. That's one underway. The trip, about a 14-hour trip if the weather wasn't too bad. And again, as I mentioned, you can see they've got things stacked on top of the ore buckets, and if you had your vehicle or other stuff being shipped in, my mother always told about, she was down at the dock the day that our household goods came in, and she sat and watched them pick up the pallet and swing her entire household out over the water and set it on the ground, and she said it was pretty intimidating to think your whole life was swinging over the water there. course, in those days we didn't have a lot. It was just a small truck. But again, the critical link of the production system. This couple's name is Barstead, and they were the original Honeymoon Heights couple. They came in 1931 when Hal Sound started. He was in charge of the development work that started in 1931, and they lived in one of the cabins at Honeymoon Heights. And this couple is John and Ruth Bly, who lived in Chalet 7, where I'm staying now. I took pictures to send to their kids because the girls will not recognize Chalet 7 inside anymore. It's one of the remodeled ones. But it was the mine superintendent's chalet. They were one of the original Honeymoon Heights couples. The reason the name Honeymoon Heights came about is that area up there is where all those different companies that were trying to do development and that had built cabins and some bunkhouses and things. And when these guys were graduating from college in 1937, John and his wife graduated from Washington State College. By the way, he was a star linebacker and could have gone pro, but decided he needed what they made in those days. He was going to start his career. But they were all marrying their college sweethearts, and those wives weren't going to live on the outside somewhere when they were newlyweds, so they started moving into those cabins and buildings up on Honeymoon Heights. Read in pieces about Honeymoon Heights that two families actually took one of the old bunkhouses and chopped it in half and pulled it apart and made an entryway and had a duplex out of it. So that's why it got called Honeymoon Heights, because there were so many newlyweds up there. He's the one that they came back to reunions. As a kid, I could have cared less about the operation of the mine, but I learned a lot listening to John Bly and his wife.
When was this picture taken?
They were back visiting, I want to say, in the late 70s, maybe. And they did, they're one of the ones, when some of the mining people came back, they did forums here in Quintanilla, and of course they were done at the time when they were recording them on tape, and they've now been converted to DVDs. It's pretty interesting to listen to some of those recordings. I've got copies of all of them. One of the things I always laughed about, Ruth talking about, you women would appreciate, there was no grocery store until 1947, so all the groceries came from the outside, and she said you'd send a blank check and your list to Safeway. And if they didn't have what was on your list, you got something in place of it because they knew you needed food. So she said you might have ordered chicken and got rabbit or something else, but you always got something. They were very good about that. This is a picture taken at Main Street. I believe this was taken after the close down because it's a colored picture. A couple things to point out here. First of all, you can see Quintanilla looked a little different. This was Lodge 5. The bottom of Lodge 6, we called him Dorm 6, had been converted to the grocery store in 47. So this little loading dock out here was for the grocery store. And then the building immediately behind here, that's where the fire truck was located. And it's right across the street from where the Garbo dock is. There's a hydrant in the Garbo dock, and that's where all the fire equipment was. Unfortunately, that building was one of the early ones that fell down. I've seen some pictures of it, but that was the fire thing. You can also see the porch on the post office. And of course, the streets very, very, very different when it was an industrial center. And if you come to my program Friday night, I'll show you a lot of pictures that you see the transition between the two communities. This is a picture, whoops, it looked too fast on me again. This is the inside of the Deutsch Center, and quite plain as you can see, it was multi-purpose just as it is today. They played basketball there. This looks to me like a dance, but it's not a formal dance like the New Year's dance, so I'm guessing this might have been one of the Mucker's balls. But the basic structure is all still there. And again, like you have it today in your village center, we called it the rec hall, but it was very multi-purpose. Basketball, movies, programs, dances. The only time the floor was uncovered, though, was if they were playing basketball and for a dance. All the rest of the time, the floor was covered with big sheets of canvas. and then the chairs were set up when there were programs or movies. And of course the bowling alley, and at that time the pin setting machines were totally manual. They've got motors on them now to push them down, but you still have to load the pins in. In the mining days, they not only were manually loaded, but they had big bars to push them down, and that's how guys made extra money, was setting pins for league nights. And bowling was a very popular sport for the both men and women, recreation. And I don't have a picture of the pool hall, but that was the other part of the camp. This is a picture of Winston Camp. But some of you walked there with me yesterday. There were 101 homes up there. That shiny roof down in the lower right corner, that's where the lady with all the cats lived. That was the house behind the rock wall we stopped at by the Forest Service cabin. And again, you can see, as I described to you, how the houses were in rows. The bottom row, middle row, top row. And you can also get an appreciation, I hope, in looking that these were nice-sized homes. These were, they weren't little mining shacks. These homes were equivalent to anything being built on the outside during that same period of time. Very nice inside. Ours had knotty pine paneling. The one next to us, which is going to show up better in another picture, three stories, because the family that built it had 10 kids.
Wow.
I think seven of them were still at home, living at home when they moved to the mining. So very nice homes. And again, you can see how they were built up the hillside. This is a winter picture. I'll show this because we walked there yesterday. This is the garage I talked about that the tree was, and this is my house here. And again, you can see that nice front porch, how we had that lovely view.
Are those avalanche chutes on the top right?
Yes, there are. And sometimes, when I first came, people asked me why the management made the miners build their houses so far away. Was that because they didn't want to be associated with them? Actually, there's two avalanche chutes in there. The trees are so grown up you can't see them now, but as I was telling the people yesterday, after the avalanche came down and took out part of the footbridge across the road in late 49, those of us in the kids that went to school in the 50s during the spring, they were actually had a patrol system where parents and teachers patrolling us through the avalanche chute when there was danger. So yeah, there were two huge chutes there. This is the picture taken in the middle row, and this is the one I referred to yesterday as the new addition where the houses fell down earlier. This is where you're going through right now on the trails to get to the bypass trail to stay off the road. And by the way, that house on the right up above that cement mall, that's the one that that work truck driver lived in. This is the picture again of the start of Winston Camp. You can see the shiny roof, that's the cat lady's house. The building on the left is the garage, and that great big tall house, the three stories in the building, middle is the one I was talking about. And this again was the start of it, the village. And you know, the community was very much a community like the outside. We had youth activities, Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Movers, Campfire Girls. We had Little Baton Twirling Group. The women's had bridge clubs and orthopedic guilds. So there was plenty of activities. It was a very family-oriented community. And the company, again, you know, they encouraged activities and like the use of the recreation hall, because that was a way of retaining good workers. This is a picture of the middle row, a different location, but again, you can get the idea of why people had joint walkways during the wintertime to share snow shoveling. Some of the ones on the top row had covered steps going up to their houses. This is a picture of the road to Lucerne, and again, it gives you an appreciation for how high the snow got. Some of you may be aware there was a, it was, Holden was written up in Life magazine in 1956, because the winter of 55-56 they had record snowfalls up here over 600 inches. People were tunneling into their homes at that time. This little hill is the last hill between the bottom and middle row if you're headed out to the to the trails, you'll see this go down. This was a favorite sledding hill. Sledding was a popular winter sport, and we had skiing also and a rope tow. This is a picture is taken in the spring. You can see that the melt started because you can see part of the wall and part of the picket fence over here, but sleds again parked in the entryway. Rick Denning used to say when he did this program, well, there's the sleds by the back door. And I said, Rick, nobody's back door was shoveled into in the winter. One door only. You had a window you could get out in emergency, but the door wasn't available. Oh, I do have the picture of the ski hill here. You can see the rope going, the two strands of rope going through the, if you look between the skiers there. Off to the right is a foam pole that had a big rim off an ore truck on it, and the motor was mounted on a toboggan at the top of the hill, so you grabbed a hold of the rope and up the hill you went. That was our skier, and that was located to the just west of the top row of houses, close to the intersection where that little sledding hill takes off. We didn't do cross-country skiing in those days. It was only downhill skiing. And people did have their cars up here during the summer, but during the winter they were not allowed to keep them here, so they had to either ship them out somewhere, or most of them just took them down and parked them at Lucerne, disconnected the batteries, and there they sat till spring. So that was the big parking lot down. That was area was located not too far from where the dock is. Holden was a company town. There was no alcohol available for sale in the town, and alcohol was never sold at or provided at any public activity. You could have it in your private homes, but personal space. But they did have a tavern at Lucerne, which was one of the reasons for having a car during the summertime up there. Also going to down for swimming and picnicking. Swimming was not allowed in the creek. So I am told that is not a bear, it is a dog. That's what they told me. Rudy put the program together, I'll take his word for it. That was the script I was given, but kind of looks like a bear, doesn't it? And this is a picture of the work starting to dismantle the third level after the mine closed, with a beautiful shot of bananas in the back. You're going to see two more quick slides that were Rudy had in here. That this is a picture of the sidewall of the assay office, and then the foundation of the assay office. And one of the reasons the Forest Service enabled them to build a building for the museum was because they were able to use the foundation from the assay office. And if you look beyond the wall, that dark piece of metal there, that's part of that big vat I was telling you about, the process for the mill process. And then we end it with a pretty nice sunset over Buckskin. So that's a little bit of the history of how the mine started and what the process was like and what the community was like. And if anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. And I encourage you to take a look at the crops we have here. So.